a job down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a minute till I can pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour on listener support community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and broadcasting live worldwide at www.weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. All right, here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And this hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber. He believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And we've got a very special show today. Socialist City Council member Shama Sawant is going to be calling in at 11:30 at 11:30 for an interview. And anyway, I want to basically let everybody know that we're in pledge drive. And, you know, unfortunately, twice a year we have to, try to get money from the listeners in order to keep us on the air because, you know, it costs money to pay the power bills to keep the station running. And you're not going to get this kind of music or public affairs program on corporate radio. Most recently, we lost a local radio station in Farmer City, the WIP, with had a very unique blues and Americana music, and a corporate entity bought them out, and now it's the same old corporate homogenized
classic rock.
Yes. Homogenized corporate product.
I was going to use a word there, but I won't use that word.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, it's terrible these days.
Yes, and it's just basically, you know, they destroyed all of its uniqueness, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people used to tune into that radio station from all around the country, as they probably do to us, you know, because of the uniqueness and diversity, different type of music they had there.
Yes, and if you want to call in and help keep us on the air, please call in at 359-9338. That's 217, area code, 359-9338. Okay, Bob, what do you have for us today as far as some news?
Yeah, we talked about this a couple times over the past month or so, but the rail union members finally voted down that Burlington Northern Santa Fe proposal to cut the train crew size. And so a tentative agreement to reduce train crew size on one of the nation's largest rail carriers has failed, according to the labor union, whose members voted on it this week. The pact would have eliminated onboard conductors on 60% of BNSF Railway, which spans the western two-thirds of the country. The vote represents a defeat for the railroad. It's based in Fort Worth, Texas, and owned by billionaire investor Warren Buffett. BNSF sought union approval to operate most trains with a single engineer on lines where they're protected by what they call positive train control, a collision avoidance system required by Congress in 2008. So, according to the railroad, they said that the The union members had voted against it. They said this was the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, and Rail Transportation Workers decided not to adopt the changes. Under the PAC, the engineers would have received a pay boost, and conductors would have been given the opportunity to become engineers. They were going to do away with conductors on the trains. Quite a thing for the railroad union to get together. It caused a lot of mobilization of the union employees up there. They finally came together and voted this down with BNSF.
So okay.
We've got a rail person here in the studio.
You mean the United Transportation Union has a victory?
They're saying this was the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, and Rail Transportation Workers.
Oh,
so maybe a slightly different.
Not my union.
Yeah.
Unless it's merged. Unless it's merged or something, because that's a lot of those have been happening. Yeah. Okay. Jim, what is that's been interesting you in the news of late that hasn't really maybe been reported on at all or reported in a slanted way by the corporate media in this country?
All right. Well, off of RT, the Russia Today program that John Kerry said is nothing but a propaganda bullhorn, the Russia Today program. And another old lady says, uh-oh, Johnny's angry.
So now they're using that as a promo for the station,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, oh, definitely, definitely. And so we find out what's going on in the Ukraine this week, all right? Poroshenko had such a humiliating defeat by the freedom fighters in the eastern Ukraine that he had to call a ceasefire in order to regroup. Now, how long this is going to last, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the most interesting part of this is that this guy Kolomovsky, who's the head of the right sector,
the fascist party?
Yeah, he's an oligarch himself.
Mm-hmm.
Probably even richer than Poroshenko is, who's another oligarch.
Mm-hmm.
But he runs what's called the National Guard. And his hero, Kolomovsky, by not only being the right sector and owning the oil or the gasoline pipeline, has now on his board Joe Biden's son.
You're kidding.
Oh, really?
this is true. And so they're openly fascist. Now,
I got a question about Joe Biden's son.
Yeah.
Is this the same son that was sort of peripherally involved in the Cliven Bundy Ranch situation over it's like a land swap kind of a deal. There was some other land. I'll try and look.
Okay,
that
yeah, all right.
There was,
right.
That was a big thing.
There was another one. Yeah.
Came up with it was Joe Biden's son was somehow involved and might financially
really
be rewarded if Bundy was not allowed to run his cattle or whatever.
Interesting.
It had something to do with that turtle, you know, and different land. And I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to look into that.
I will.
Okay.
But I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that the United States is linked up with fascists. We did it with the Nazis in Germany before World War II. We had, of all people, the Koch brothers' father was.
So was Prescott Bush, George Prescott W. Bush's grandfather.
Exactly. And IBM did a lot of work on their encoding devices. So, I mean, Washington loves fascists,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, it was common knowledge when you read books or magazines or newspapers back in the 1930s, before World War II, how the country club set and the upper ranks of the military in the United States loved Mussolini. I mean, just, and Franco, you know, lavished praise on them endlessly. Now, Hitler was a little rough for them, you know, that they wouldn't publicly say they supported him, but boy, they had no qualms about, you know, heaping praise on Mussolini and Franco.
Well, Mussolini was not an anti-Semite. See, Italy, you know, there weren't a huge Jewish population in Italy. In fact, Mussolini had a Jewish mistress.
Huh. How interesting.
No, seriously.
Yeah, okay. Now, what, and, as far as the Ukraine, though, getting back to the Ukraine, you know, I saw an article by Michael Hudson, who's, a really good economist out of the University of Kansas City.
Missouri.
Who's been on, Democracy Now! And a lot of other, alternative American television programs over the past. And he said that the IMF is lending money, huge amount of money to the current government of Ukraine, which, by the way, has banned the two largest political parties, the Communist Party and another party, from even participating in the elections or being a member of them.
Right.
The IMF is breaking all the rules, giving a huge amount of money to a country that's currently in a civil war conflict, because that's supposed to be one of the IMF's, prohibitions. They don't lend any money to if there's a country going to civil war. But what's interesting, all this money is being allocated to certain segments of the economy. In other words, none of it's going to be allocated to rebuild eastern Ukraine whenever there's a settlement there of some kind of autonomy. And in fact, the article mentions that it's basically going to give a lot of cover for the oligarchs and the other wealthy in Ukraine to move their money offshore real fast, most of that being probably going to be that IMF loan.
Right.
And the people in the Ukraine, the average people, are going to be even more impoverished, probably more so than even Greece.
Okay, well, the IMF makes the loan, but the World Bank gives them the money.
Correct.
And the head of the World Bank is Christine Lagarde.
Mm-hmm.
She's already been accused of bank fraud, and there's a warrant out for
arrest. Really?
Yeah, but they're not going to touch her till after her tour of duty is over. And she's probably going to end up in the slammer.
Yeah.
I mean, we're watching capitalism implode on itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a question of if, it's when there's going to be an international monetary collapse. Debt is just, we run on debt.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't understand is why Wall Street isn't the target from Europe. I mean, back in, from 2005 to 2008 to the collapse, maybe even started before that, we were selling all these bundled toxic assets, AAA rated by Moody's, and that's what brought everything down in Europe, especially Greece and Spain and Italy and Portugal.
And Ireland to a certain degree.
And Ireland to a certain degree.
So, and also the case with Iceland, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Iceland.
Oh, I had sons mixed up. It was Harry Reid's son.
Harry Reid's son. Okay.
Leader of the Senate.
Okay. All right. But you know, this is just ridiculous. I mean, you know, what we're hearing in the corporate media. I mean, you know, working with people during the week, you know, interacting with various average working people. I mean, the crap I'm hearing that they're telling me that they're hearing off of the corporate media stations is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, it's making it sound like the Russians have invaded the Ukraine, and you know,
well,
that
you
this
work with that people that talk about stuff like that
occasionally, and then the Ukraine is this fragile little democracy that's trying to hold on and modernize their country, doing reforms. One of those code words they used for basically. That means privatization. But nothing could be further from the truth. You got a government that basically came to power not in a democratic election, but an actual violent coup, which the majority of the people involved in the violent coup that ended up killing people, including, you know, policemen and other average citizens, were outright fascists. And then when they got into power, they used basically autocratic powers to impose governorships on different provinces. 30% of these governors are from that right-wing fascist party.
Yeah.
And they banned the two largest political parties that were existing in the Ukraine. So this is no democracy. And Russia's not, I mean, you know, they say Russia's imperial ambitions. How many military bases does Russia have around the world?
Yeah.
I really don't know. I think maybe they have one in Syria, perhaps.
Yeah.
How many United States military bases are around the world? It's about going to be over 1,000. So who's the imperial aggressor here? You know, not that I have any great love for Putin or Russia, but let's put things into perspective here about who's the bigger threat here to world peace and democracy.
Yeah. Well, you know, Russia's a capitalist country. However, I have to have say that Putin and his advisors, whatever circle that is, have been playing their cards masterfully here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there really technically was no invasion. However, there were thousands of volunteers.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the weaponry that was used was stuff that was when it, that were in bunkers that were from Soviet times.
That was a lot of those were in Ukraine, right?
In the eastern part of Ukraine.
Okay.
So,
and let's ask ourselves, what would the United States government do if something similar was happening in Mexico?
Yeah.
You know, that's what you need to keep in perspective here. Well, anyway, listen, this is really fascinating, Jim, and I'm really, appreciate you coming on the show and giving us a little update and stuff because, man, I'll tell you that RT station, I mean, whenever they say something about Russia, you gotta kind of maybe take it with a grain of salt, but boy, I tell you, it's a different perspective, which I think helps see things, you know, try to sort out all the lies out there. And, Abby Martin in particular, one of the hosts of has a program, she's great. I mean, in fact, she even, came up against the RT board at one point with a disagreement, and she still had her job, which wouldn't have happened in U.S. corporate media. She would have been gone.
Yeah, Dave, I just want to break. This is from the Examiner.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Quote, most Americans remember the recent events in the state of Nevada where Bureau of Land Management agents squared off over grazing rights of Clive and Bundy on federally managed land. As news and information progressed for this event, it was discovered that not only was Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid intricately involved in a land deal with China that was the root of the standoff, but that Reid's son was also a lobbyist for ENN Energy Group, who was allowed to purchase the land for far below face value.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, this form of crony capitalism is not being limited to just Senate Majority Leader. On May 13th, it was announced that Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, was being elected to the board of directors for Ukraine's largest gas company, and once again brings forth questions on whether U.S. involvement in Ukraine is not about standing up for democracy, but to ensure oil and gas rights for
multinationals.
Yes, it's U.S. for U.S. companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's R. Hunter Biden.
R. Hunter Biden. Oh.
Or Biden, sorry.
Oh, how dignified.
You guys are talking about
I should, as long as we're talking about RT, I had an RT or a Comcast salesman come over to the house, which was pretty funny because they claim I owe them $250, and I waited 2 months, you know, to get it. And then I just switched over to AT&T, and I have Dish. But now if you have Comcast, you can get RT, but you have to ask for it, and it'll be an additional $20 a month.
Just
wow. First you gotta go to a higher tier.
Well, no. Jim's saying that just to get that channel, just that for one channel, and they don't advertise they have it. You have to specifically ask for it. You know, it's like they're discouraging people
weird. I don't have Comcast, but see, all the cable I will not deal over one channel.
Mm-hmm.
It's like usually if you want one channel,
you got to take a whole tier. Yes,
20 channels with it and pay for
right.
It. Wow, that's strange.
Yes,
no, they won't. Well, I don't know that they'll just take that channel for $20. They said no matter what package you have, so you have the minimum package, which is Urbana Public Television, WILL, WEIU, they WGN's on there. I had mm-hmm. that. It was only $11 a month then. It's probably about $15 now. So you have to have some sort of a package, but it could be minimal, and then add $20.
Okay.
So you guys were mentioning RT in a different perspective on the news. So I just wanted to remind listeners, since we're in pledge drive, that we bring you Deutsche Welle radio news three or four times a day on weekdays here, which, again, is
a totally different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Some people outside the United States looking at things in a totally different way than our corporate media does here. So
indeed,
just another reason to keep listening to WEFT.
That's right. And if you want to call and help us stay on the air, please call 217-359-9338. Okay, 359-9338.
We're going to have everybody singing that jingle.
That's right. Okay, some quick pledge, some quick public service announcements here. Real quick, none another sports show airs on every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. on 104.5 WRFU with fellow worker Neil Parthen, and on every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6 is Labor's Worldview TV, which can also be accessed broadcast live on the internet at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. And also, just to let you know that from the No More Jails campaign in Champaign County, now the county board is trying again, the Champaign County Board is again trying to build a jail. Help us stop them. Join us at the county board meeting at Brookins Administration Building, 1776 East Washington Street in Urbana on September 18th at 6:30 p.m. We've had some success over the last couple of years holding the original $20 million building plan. The Criminal Justice Task Force report, the ILPP comprehensive study, and a reentry program, but we've also seen from the county a lot of foot dragging, setbacks, and return of business as usual. The county board has recently spent more than $140,000 to pay a consultant to draw up a master plan for the satellite jail. We say spend the money on programs, not jail. Meanwhile, the county's acquisition of military equipment like the huge MRAP vehicle is sending a discouraging message in the wake of the militarization of police in Ferguson, Missouri. It has now become necessary for another big mobilization. Show your opposition to the new jail cells and the county's new military vehicle, even bigger than the one used in Ferguson. It's going to take a lot of us to turn this around. See you on September 18th. For more information, contact Mark Enslin at Enslin, E-N-S-L-I-N, .mark@gmail.com. That's E-N-S-L-I-N .mark@gmail.com. And also to let you know that there's going to be a WEFT benefit film showing at the Art Theater Co-op at 126 West Church Street in downtown Champaign on Tuesday, October 7th at 7:30 p.m. And this film is a cutting-edge new documentary called Shadows of Liberty.
Yeah, it sounds interesting.
Yes, it uses shocking examples of cover-ups and censorship by the U.S. media to show how a few mega corporations exercise control over the content of our news. And it's that it examines also the extraordinary political, social, and economic power these corporate media entities have. Having always allowed broadcasting to be controlled by commercial interests, the loosening of media ownership regulations that began under Reagan and continued under Clinton has led to the current situation where five mega corporations control the vast majority of the media that people see in the United States. These companies not only don't prioritize investigative journalism, but can and do clamp down on it when their interests are threatened. The film begins with three journalists whose careers were destroyed because of the stories they broke. Roberta Baskin, whose scoop about Nike sweatshops didn't set well with CBS when Nike became a co-sponsor of the Olympics. Christina Borgeson, another CBS reporter whose job lasted precisely 1 week after the network spiked her investigation into the TWA Flight 800 disaster in 1996. And last but not least, Gary Webb, whose story linking U.S. support for Nicaraguan Contras and the epidemic in crack cocaine importation in the United States was trashed by the New York Times and the Washington Post. His story was true, but Webb lost his job and eventually killed himself. With the help of interviewees including Daniel Ellsberg, Dan Rather, Julian Assange, Chris Hedges, Dick Gregory, Robert McChesney, John Nichols, and Amy Goodman, the film explores in depth the monopolies and vested interests that filter the dissemination of information, thus damaging our democratic process. One notorious example featured in the film of the anti-democratic nexus between the military-industrial complex and the news media was the latter's unquestioning acceptance of the former's trumped-up justification for the Iraq War. With profits taking priority over the truth and the powerful being taken at their word rather than taken to task, the film asks whether the internet can withstand corporate pressure and remain free, or will it too fall into the hands of monopolistic corporations? Ultimately, has our commercial world caused us to lose one of the most precious commodities of all, unbiased information? So that sounds like a great film.
That's a WEFT fundraiser. When is that again? October?
That's on Tuesday, October 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Art Theater Co-op, 126 West Church Street in downtown Champaign.
And WEFT is instrumental in bringing that film to the community here. So it is a fundraiser for WEFT, so come on out and do that on Tuesday, October 7th, and we got a fundraiser going on tonight too, Dave, right?
Yes, why don't you tell about us, Bob?
All right. Since
it's kind of your baby here.
We got a WEFT pledge party going on tonight, September 13th at 9 p.m., Memphis on Main. We're bringing Tweed Funk, their 2014 Soul Blues nominee for a Blues Blast Music Award, and they're two-time winners of the Wisconsin Area Music Award. So Tweed Funk, they're a great soul blues band. They're horn driven. They got a trumpet saxophone player and a great singer with them. So come on out starting at 9 o'clock. And that's a fundraiser too for WEFT. And continuing to bring you some great music, and it's going to be a good party up there at Memphis on Main, 9 o'clock this evening. So.
Okay, yes, indeed. We're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. Shama Sawant from Seattle should be calling in fairly soon, so stay tuned. You're listening to listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Okay, so stay tuned.
Wake up and get with the movement. Hear the message in the music now. We can fight back or we can lay down.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Shema Sawant.
Hello, Mrs. Sawant. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. Well, listen, we're really honored for you took time to call in today and everything. And first of all, I just I guess want to ask how things been going since your election.
Well, it's been quite a historic change in Seattle since about the middle of last year, when the mood has clearly shifted compared to the status quo of so many decades, you know, and it shows you that the anger that Occupy brought forth, you know, the anger against income inequalities hasn't gone anywhere. The establishment politicians would like to believe that that was just a one-off and we can go back to business as usual. But as you can see, the election of a socialist and the victory on $15 an hour only in a matter of months after having decades of unabated income inequality, it shows you that people really have the hunger to fight back, and I don't think it's unique to Seattle. It's happening everywhere.
Okay. And, you know, since you, as far as the 15 Now campaign, I mean, that seemed like that was like kind of one of your most responsive campaign, you know, issues, if you will. Is that the case? Were there some other issues besides the 15 Now campaign that you think helped get you elected?
Well, I think the overall vision of an alternate kind of politics, the kind of politics that will actually deliver social and economic justice to ordinary people, to working families, to the elderly and the disabled, that is, you know, fundamentally, that is what attracted people to our campaign, because, you know, people haven't seen this in so long, you know, an electoral campaign that is not based in some sort of vote-getting machine, but in real, in a real desire to build movement, a campaign that is being run by open socialist activists, you know, who are sacrificing their personal lives to push for a socialist agenda. So this campaign really galvanized people's attention, especially young people's attention, not only for the demands we put on our campaign manifesto, which you asked about and I'll talk about in a second, but also just, you know, having a campaign that openly declared that we are running in the interest of working people. We don't have divided loyalties. We are not, running in the interest of big business. And in fact, we don't take a penny from big business because we want to make that clear. We want our loyalties to be clearly on the side of the working class. And we were, you know, contrary to the conventional logic of left politics, we were not timid. We were audacious in how we ran our campaign. And it really defied the conventional logic that somehow you have to kowtow to the Democratic Party establishment. As a matter of fact, what happened was that a lot of the people on the ground, you know, just ordinary people who identify as supporters of the Democratic Party, were attracted to our campaign to the point that we had a Democrats for Sawant group that was organized, because a lot of people who usually vote Democrat came and told us, well, you know, these are the values, the values that your campaign represents are the values that I believe in, but I feel betrayed by the establishment. And so we ran on $15 an hour. That was the principal demand we ran on, but we also ran on the demands of rent control and a millionaire's tax. Both are burning issues. You know, the crisis of affordable housing is a burning issue in Seattle, and Washington State also happens to be the state with the most regressive tax system. And in fact, just to give you an illustration of how having built the 15 Now campaign and having 115, the kind of momentum grassroots politics is continuing to have, is that tomorrow hosting a town hall in one of the most diverse and low-income neighborhoods, where we're going to be discussing the questions of housing justice and discussing specific campaigns to fight for affordable housing.
Ms. Vaughn, my name is Bill. I'm a co-host on the show. And anyway, something that I was thinking about is that Seattle itself is completely dominated by the Democratic Party, much like, say, Chicago, Illinois. And one thing that I was doing some reading about your campaign, and something that was brought up was that there was no way that anybody could call you a spoiler. You know, unlike the evil Ralph Nader, you were not stealing somebody's votes. And now we have an election coming up in Chicago where there might be an independent teacher running.
Karen Lewis, so the Chicago Teachers Union, yes.
What do you think about this?
Yeah, I'm so glad you introduced that point, Bill. The fact that the spoiler argument simply does not work in most of the major cities in the United States. If you look at most of the major cities like New York City, like you said, Chicago, Seattle, these cities are dominated by the Democratic Party establishment. In Seattle, for example, Republicans are almost an unheard of entity. So if you look at the economic and social conditions that people live in these cities, the extreme inequality, look at Chicago, the school closures in black neighborhoods and the ghettoization of the black community. I mean, all of this has been happening over decades, but the Republicans haven't been responsible for this. I mean, I have no love lost for Republicans. Let's be clear. I'm a Marxist. They are the right wing. I'm fighting against them. But the reality is that the Democrats, for whatever differences they may have from the Republicans, which we have to acknowledge, do not, that the establishment of the Democratic Party does not provide an alternative to that same corporate big business right-wing agenda. And so Rahm Emanuel, who the front runner of the Democratic Party in Chicago, has been the instigator of these school closures, attacks on the teachers' union. So it's extremely critical, actually, for an independent working-class campaign to take him on and really galvanize a movement from below, the kind of movement that the Chicago Teachers Union was able to inspire during their strikes in the last half of 2012. So I think that for Karen Lewis to have declared as a nonpartisan is critical. I would say that we need that campaign to really have a working-class edge, really break from the Democratic Party establishment, not just in name, but in actuality, you know, not try to curry favors with the establishment, try to wheel and deal with them, but really break from them and run an audacious working-class campaign. I have no doubt that there is an enormous fighting mood among the people in Chicago, you know, especially if the campaign is able to bring out all those teachers, you know, all the rank-and-file union members who fought in their union battles. If it's able to bring out all the parents and the community, you know, 50,000 that supported the teachers, they're looking for something like this to happen. So it's time for that change to come, but it's important that we understand that it is not simply about running against the Democrats. It's the nature of the campaign that we run against the Democrats that's important, because people are looking for alternatives from the alternatives to the betrayals of the Democratic Party. Look at the betrayal on the immigration issues. You know, it's people are looking for some force that will really take on the issues that they care about.
Thank you very much. This is Jim Iman. I've been a lifelong socialist. I joined the Young Socialist Alliance when I was 17 years old. I'm now 71 and a retired railroad worker.
You grew up in Milwaukee, right, Jim?
I grew up in Milwaukee. When I was in high school, Frank Zeidler was the last Socialist Party mayor. And he resigned. He was never, they loved him. He extended the public commons enormously. He built parks. He built all kinds of public things, a lot of which has been privatized now. And it's sad to go back to Milwaukee and see what's happened to a beautiful city like that Frank and the Socialist Party built. In fact, the socialist leader, which Carl Sandburg, one of our heroes here in Illinois, was a reporter and very close to the leadership, was, you know, as a lot of people don't know about Sandburg, you know, it was Emil Zeidel. But anyway, coming from that background, I would like to know what, for the listeners, what the program is for the Socialist Alternative Organization compared to, let's say, the International Socialist Organization or others.
Well, I think primarily at this moment, I would stress, I mean, I can talk a little bit about Socialist Alternatives Program and how we might be somewhat different. But I would like for our listeners to remember that at this moment, it is absolutely the urgent responsibility of the U.S. left, you know, whatever label people might choose or whatever organization you might belong to. If you are on the left and you think that it's time for some sort of change to happen, and if you feel inspired by what Socialist Alternatives is in Seattle, then the overarching question we have to pose for ourselves is, how can we enable the, you know, the real building of the mass U.S. left? And I think the most urgent question is, that faces us, is the question of building a mass political alternative. And, you know, what I specifically mean is a mass political formation, a political party for the people who feel completely disengaged by the two parties of big business, and a party, a working class party that will base itself in social movement and to galvanize social movement, and will have, will arrive at a program that may not identify as socialist per se, but will identify as clearly having broken from the two-party system, broken from corporate politics, and really aggressively advance an agenda for the working class, an agenda for sustainable economy and against climate change and so on.
Well, I see.
But having said that, you know, I think it is important to recognize that there are differences. So if we come together, you know, I think one of the first steps should be for the left to have a series of national meetings where we can discuss these things, and we should discuss them openly. You know, we should talk about what unified program we can come up with, but we should be honest about our differences. It is extremely critical. I mean, for example, Socialist Alternative will enter such a discussion with an honest appraisal of what our differences are. And for us, those differences are important outline, because we think that it is important that we be true to what we feel. And I think one of the key differences between Socialist Alternative right now and other organizations is that a lot of organizations identified that there was an opening for the left, especially since Occupy, and that the whole Obama charm had started to wear off. I mean, it's a complex process, but it was clear that 2012 was not 2008. The Obama mania didn't exist anymore, and that people were, you know, fumbling around in the darkness for something different. But it was only Socialist Alternative that had the clarity and the audacity to run electoral campaigns at a time when other socialist organizations were either hesitant or even critical to some degree. So I think that we base ourselves, you know, what you've seen us do is really a live sort of enactment of our understanding of the transitional approach. You know, how do you, as Marxists, how do you engage in the politics of your time? How do you assess the consciousness of the mass of the working class? Not be condescending, but at the same time acknowledge where it is. And how do you run a campaign that will echo with people? So the campaign manifesto that we had last year that called for $15 an hour was not an accident. We had a very clear and sort of crystallized assessment of the consciousness, of the mood of working people, And it was becoming clear towards the end of 2012 that $15 an hour was going to be one of the main issues that would galvanize working people's attention, especially young workers. So I think it's that kind of clear perspectives that distinguishes socialist alternative at this moment. And as I said, that's not an accident. That's a result of very intense discussions and debates that we have within our organizations to arrive at the correct conclusions. And I think that going forward, that's the kind of clarity the U.S. left needs. And one of the most urgent questions, and I will close with this, is, you know, what are we going to do in 2016? You know, we have a lot of disagreements among the left, but we also have a lot of agreement that is an urgent necessity to produce a genuine left alternative. But the best way to do that, to, you know, alternative to Hillary Clinton, 4 years of Hillary Clinton, the best way to do that is for us to come together and see if we can run one strong left campaign that can galvanize the attention of millions, maybe even tens of millions of people around the nation.
Well, I have heard that Bernie Sanders was thinking of running as a third-party candidate. However, he made the giant error of supporting Israel in the last offensive in Gaza. And so he's off my list. I've never voted for a Republican or Democrat in my life. It's always been third party on the left. We've made one exception, and that's a local lady here, Carol Ammons, who's a grassroots workers organizer running for state rep.
And she's running as a Democrat just because it's a tactical.
And she was also very much opposed by the
state Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Yes, the corporate candidate. Vicious campaign against her. So, you know, I guess, you know, I think you have a great point.
Establishment.
Yes, Ms. Swan, is that, you know, I don't know. I'm not really aligned with any tendency or whatever. I mean, I'm a carpenter, working class person, you know, from working class family. And to me, I think the important thing is, you know, the issues that not only help working people, but empower them. And I think this statement you made about trying to have a conference to find, you know, issues of unity and also issues that will inspire working people is just, I commend you. I think this is an excellent idea.
Well, so here's another one, Dave. I was doing some reading and I knew there was going to be a lot about just against electoral politics in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I always take an inductive approach to life, to where I take in everything and then I start throwing things out.
Yeah.
And I truly support Carol and Kishama here. And I think we need, unfortunately, I'm going to quote Barack Obama's energy policy. We need an all-of-the-above politics.
Mm-hmm.
We need – democracy is in the streets. Democracy is in letters. Democracy is in petitions. Democracy is in voting. However, elections are not – elections are necessary, but they are not sufficient for a truly democratic process. There's a lot more that goes to it.
Sure, sure. Ms.
Absolutely.
Yes,
I mean, just to weigh in on that, you know, that's absolutely correct. That, in fact, I would say, in a sort of ironic, I suppose, some listeners might find that right after one of the most historic election victories to hear me say this, but in reality, electoral terrain is not the most favorable to build radical movements, and certainly as Marxists, it's not the most favorable terrain. However, as the person put it, it is a necessary component of building a fight back, because as long as the vast majority of people are, you know, sort of failing and, you know, looking at the Republicans and Democrats and wondering, you know, there is no other entity in the political arena. And so because of that vacuum, by default, I have to support the Democratic Party. That is the problem. As long as people are engaged in that kind of thinking, we do need to run electoral campaigns. But it is not simply, I would put it somewhat differently than simply saying it's all of the above, because I don't think the answers are that simple. I mean, I think it's a question of what should be done in a given period. You know, in 2012, it really made sense for us to run a big electoral campaign here statewide, because everybody was, you know, saying, okay, Occupy is now died down, you know, let's hunker down and make sure the Democrats are reelected. So, you know, at that moment, it really was a pivotal thing for us to provide an alternative. But it's not going to be so straightforward that in a given year an electoral campaign is the campaign we should run. You know, I think we should have an ongoing critical assessment of the conditions on the ground. You know, we have to have a finger on the pulse and understand what should be done. But it is absolutely clear that at this moment there is really not an excessiveness of left electoral campaigns. In reality, there is a paucity of electoral campaigns on the left. If you look at the opening that there is, a hunger for left politics, you will find examples few and far between. There's socialist alternatives. There's the potential for Karen Lewis's campaign to be a genuinely working class campaign, but that needs to be, that's not going to happen by itself, by magic. That needs to be developed consciously. And there's, you know, Harvey Hawkins' campaign for governor in New York, which I think all the people on the left should support. It's a very good campaign. But those are too few and far between. And I would say that the opportunities that are open to us have not been explored to any full degree. And I would say the next big thing, since, you know, we're talking on Saturday, September 13th, the next big thing people should be having their eyes on is the next weekend, the People's Climate March in New York City. We're having solidarity marches in various cities. Seattle is planning for a huge march here with virtually every environmental organization that is in the sponsorship. I think that this is an opportunity for us to, as your speaker said, you know, bring issues together and raise the question of breaking from the Democrats, because there is no other more urgent, in some ways, no more urgent issue that calls for a break from the Democrats than their complete and utter failure to provide any strategy for climate change. You know, Obama's all-of-the-above strategy for climate change is just completely bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. You know, what was it like after you got elected and you went to your first city council meeting? Did you have a chilly reception from the other council members? Were there any that were at least somewhat, you know, cordial with you? How's that dynamic play out when you first walked in as an elected city council person?
I think, you know, to my face, everybody was very cordial. Mm-hmm. But I had heard a lot of things, like, for example, a stranger, the local, you know, left newspaper here, reported that soon after the election victory was apparent, one of the council members had been overheard as having said that, wow, having a open socialist here is like having a mountain lion loose in a grocery store. I'm not sure where that metaphor comes from, but I took it as a compliment.
Indeed.
To mean that, you know, we're finally, after having decades of being sort of ossified in this, you know, sort of ivory tower of very bourgeois, you know, big business type of politics, for the first time in 100 years, you had a genuine voice for the working class within City Hall. So I think we have to recognize that the easiest way for the corporate media and for the politicians that represent the status quo, the easiest way for them to undercut and ultimately tear down an uprising of the left, you know, in this way, is to pick, you know, figureheads of the movement and try to tear them down. So it should be expected. We on the left should expect that they will make derogatory comments. They will make completely, you know, they will use complete lies to talk about what it's like to have a socialist in City Hall. But we should understand that they're not doing that because they're personally motivated against me as a person. What they are fighting against, and this is a rational thing for them to do because they represent the ruling class of interest, they're fighting against the movement that is represented mm-hmm. by the fact that a socialist sits in City Hall, and that is what terrifies them. And ultimately, that is going to be the force that is going to bring about any defeat to the ruling class's brutal agenda and bring about victories for the working class. And not only victories, but as you said, this is not just about the substantive improvements in the standards of living. It's about empowering the working class to go ahead to build stronger movements, because they're not just fighting for reforms. We need to call for a systemic transformation altogether. But that's going to happen only if tens of millions of people feel empowered to get involved in the fight back. And the only way for what genuine Marxists to use political space is, if at every moment we are building, we're helping to build that fighting force of the working class. It's not about our personal careers, but it's about making that happen. But that is precisely what terrifies the ruling class.
Okay.
And so, the only way to defeat them is to continue building that movement so that there's not just one socialist on the city council in one city, but many of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, sort of a two-part question. Do you have a lot of your supporters turn out during council meetings to kind of give you backup and support? And has there, we get very little news here in central Illinois. Like, you really have to dig to find out information about what's been going on with you in Seattle. But one thing really made it through here loud and clear was when you supported a resolution against the Israeli government's bombing of Gaza. And I guess one other council member actually sided with you on that. So I guess it's a two-part question.
Yeah, I think, and both are important questions. One, I'll answer the second question first.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, as evidenced by the fact that another council member voiced support for the statement against the atrocities of the Israeli state in Gaza and calling for U.S. Congress to stop.
Which member was that, by the way? I'm just curious.
It was council member Nick Licata.
Nick Licata, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it should be a reminder for us that we have to have a sophisticated, not a simplistic assessment of politics. And so the political forces of the ruling class are not homogeneous or monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
And as the crisis of capitalism worsens, more and more of those cracks are going to emerge. And it's important for us to recognize that. And I would say, just from a local political standpoint, the city council, of course, I'm on the left, I'm a Marxist, but there are one or two council members, including council member Nick Licata, who are extremely genuine. We have political disagreements with them, and they're very honest about that. They are very honest about their disagreements. And the main disagreement, of course, is whether or not to break openly from the Democratic Party, because at the end of the day, you're serving, as a Democrat, you're serving the Democratic Party's agenda. The other difference also comes in tactics and strategies that are used to fight for working people. And I think everybody would agree that there are a lot of genuinely social justice-minded people out there who may have disagreements with us on our tactics, but I would say that if you look at the incredible speed with which $15 an hour was won and the spirit of the struggle that was ignited in Seattle in such a short time, I think it is very clear evidence. I mean, there's a lot of evidence in history books, but there's a contemporary evidence that it is actually fighting strategies that are needed, timidly trying to, gently push the envelope on the Democratic, what is acceptable to the Democratic Party, does not work. And I would say that in order for movement building, we join hands with people who are genuinely fighting with us on the same causes. But we're also very clear in stating that for a movement to curtail itself, to limit itself only by what is expedient or convenient for the very establishment that we're trying to counter, is suicidal. I mean, look at the gay rights struggle, for example. Sorry if I'm going on a bit, but Bill Clinton signed the Defense of Marriage Act, and he was proudly proclaiming that on, more conservative Christian-oriented radio shows and so on. And then now that the movement, after, 20 years, just activists on the ground, gay rights activists being fed up, they feeling betrayed with the Democratic Party, took the struggle statewide for marriage, on a state level, marriage equality. Now, big-time Democrats like Bill Clinton come out and declare their support. They haven't led on any of the important issues that make any change in people's lives. And so I think the examples just abound, and so we are very, we are relentless in stating that it is important to work, break away from the establishment. But that does not mean that we are not willing to work with people who are genuinely willing to work on issues. And so you can see those kinds of differences on the city council as well. Just another example, to give you another example, Councilmember Nick Licata and I also together proposed a progressive taxation option to prevent some of the cuts that have been imminent in the bus transit network in the city. And we didn't get any support. There were only two votes, him and me. But that illustrates that there are opportunities to work together, but that has to be done in a principled manner. You know, that cannot be, what you work together on has to be decided based on what is good for the working class, what fights for the working class, not what is convenient for the establishment. And so we have to be willing to work, but we have to also be willing to part ways on a principled basis. And that we are demonstrating, that it is, there is no reason to be isolated on the city council if we know how to work while being principled. And as far as bringing people into city politics, that has been perhaps the most crucial tool in our hands to be able to use the city council office effectively. I mean, we didn't run the election, and we didn't occupy the city council office simply to go there every day, hobnob with the big names in the city and, you know, go to wine and cheese. We're running that like an organizer's office. And it is taking the establishment politicians completely by surprise, but it's also, it's very clear that it's a real breath of fresh air for the working class in Seattle. I am not exaggerating to you when I say that just ordinary workers, you know, workers who haven't been politically involved or engaged, you know, people, workers who are just barely getting by, desperate to make a living, they don't watch TV, they're not hooked on social media or any, they don't read the newspapers, but they know that this office, you know, Shemason's office, is the office that fights for workers. And so we often get phone calls from workers that we have never met before saying, I'm facing a systematic wage theft in my office. My boss is harassing me. I want to do something. Yesterday, we got a call from a worker at a local restaurant chain who said that he is just, you know, he's just dying to unionize. He went and told his boss, I want to unionize, and I'm calling Shemason's office because I want to unionize. And so those are just, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate. These are not every one of these phone calls is shaping up into a big movement. You know, it takes time and it takes effort and it's hard work. But the point is that it is becoming apparent to people that this is the kind of politics we need. And $15 an hour would not have been won had not the people, the workers on the street, the activists of 15 now, members of the labor movement, both organizers and, you know, workers themselves, had they not shown up repeatedly in city hall chambers demanding $15 an hour, demanding that the council fight for them, you know, demanding that other council members vote with me against the corporate loopholes. And it really showed people in a live demonstration that these are all Democrats and here's a socialist, and this is virtually the only person, you know, sometimes I had one or two members with me, but virtually the only person fighting against the corporate loopholes. And who are the people introducing the corporate loopholes? It's the Democratic Party politicians. It was quite breathtaking to see that, and see that people were starting to understand that difference, you know, between a real fighting political force on City Hall and everybody else. But it was primarily people being engaged in that movement and being participating actively in that movement, putting their personal lives aside for a few months.
I agree with you completely on this. The Democratic Party, I have always held, is the main enemy of the working class and has been. For whatever Franklin Delano Roosevelt did, he did because he had to do it to save capitalism. The one time that we had was in the 30s to build a labor party was when John L. Lewis was a household name.
And he was a Republican.
But he could have actually formed a labor party. But I
I believe that electoral politics is mainly to be used when you're in office as a bully pulpit, or even the election campaign, even if you aren't successful. You know, it's a tool to get the message out. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dave. My final words here are, the only solution is revolution.
Okay. Oh, I have to yes. say what real quick.
Yes.
Ms. Avant was talking about, you know, everything can be used, but in certain situations, it's not good.
Yes.
It was good to go into electoral politics in this instance in Seattle. It didn't work out too well in Wisconsin.
Yes, indeed.
So that's another point right there. And it might work out real well in Chicago.
Yes. But, you know, I'm really...
But I don't think we can have a schematic approach either. I mean, yes, electoral politics is only a tool. But, you know, look at the $15 an hour example. It's not that simply that the city council office we got after we were elected was, it's not as simple as saying that it was a bully pulpit. No, it was one of the principles. Our campaign last year was one of the two or three principal factors on the ground that even made $15 an hour an agenda, let alone win the victory. The other principal factor was the labor movement fighting for $15 an hour on a voters initiative in SeaTac, a neighboring city of Seattle, for airport workers. So I think we have to be careful in how we characterize the role of different tools that are at our disposal. Electoral politics can, if used by the used in with fighting strategies, be the prime motivators for movements. But also remembering that it is not going to be the only way in which people are going to be attracted. And ultimately, you know, that's the challenge, you know. At this moment, you know, I can also talk about revolution. And, that's what we're fighting for. You know, we're fighting for a fundamental transformation of the global society away from capitalism to democratic socialism. That is what we're giving up our lives for. But if it were as simple as saying, well, you know, I'm for revolution, then the question of how are we going to build the mass movements that are political movements that are going to be essential to overthrow capitalism remains completely unanswered. Because the question is, where are those people going to come from? Why are they going to be part of a movement? We know that, you know, capitalism creates the conditions, objective conditions, to revolt against itself. But that is not going to be enough. Our task as Marxists is to actually make sure that we use this, use a transitional way in which we can bring people into political movements. And also, I would go as far as to say that it is important what organizations people join. I mean, I would urge people to join Socialist Alternative. Fully realizing that we need to build broader forces on the left, because it is important to join those organizations that are developing the kind of leadership that we need to really build these movements. It is absolutely critical that people do that.
Yes, you know, and take an example where Jim grew up in Milwaukee back in the early part of the 1900s. The term for the socialist city council and mayor there was called sewer socialists, because they dealt with pragmatic, practical issues that, both helped and empowered the working class. Anything from public transportation to, in cleaning up the environment or what have you. And I think that, if I'm not mistaken, that seems to be kind of your approach as well, is to actually do concrete things to get people inspired to basically come on board. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it, yes, but I would put it somewhat differently. I mean, I would start with the starting point of, what is it that gets working people, especially young working people, because, in every era, the young layers of workers are going to provide the leading forces, the fighting forces of working class movement.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that brings them into political struggle? It is going to be, I cannot provide a blueprint for every period in every region.
Sure.
But it is going to be demands that are related to their material realities in many ways. And when I say material, I don't necessarily mean just money or economic. But, you know, for example, the whole question of climate change is a very good example for us to see that a whole layer of young people, you know, who identify as environmental activists and climate change activists are looking for fundamental solutions. I mean, at this moment, there is a lot of understanding, developing understanding. It's an evolution, but it's a developing understanding that capitalism has not, has failed to provide a solution. So we can't go to them simply and say, okay, let's fight for revolution. We have to say, okay, how do we build a fighting program against climate change? What does that actually mean on the ground? You know, how can we run campaigns that provide an alternative to this, you know, jobs or environment kind of paradigm that is presented falsely by the capitalist class? And talk about the question of a just transition, meaning all the jobs that are in the coal sector and the oil sector, we need a massive public works program to provide unionized jobs in the renewable energy sector and firm building mass transit and so on. So that's an example of how you take a concrete material demand but politicize it so that you help people to come into a political movement and then, you know, engage them, continue to engage them and discuss and you know, help them understand that then ultimately there are two things. One is that even fighting for that one reform is going to be phenomenally difficult because it pits you directly against the forces of capitalism. I mean, imagine if you went out with a demand of, you know, just transition from the oil sector into renewable energy. That is unachievable just by itself. I mean, it's meaningless in some way to just say that because, you know, if you want to actually build that movement, you're going to be directly pitted against the top five oil corporations of the world. You know, that's almost like a revolutionary demand in some ways. But it's important to discuss these concrete questions with people because otherwise it is not going to be clear how are we going to transition from here to a just and sustainable society. It seems an intractable problem without having these transitional approaches, but always clarifying that you have to go beyond the reforms. So, you know, fighting the reforms themselves will develop, the process of fighting for reforms develops a revolutionary consciousness among people. It is not simply talking about revolution that develops it. But then
I agree, be honest
and go ahead, go beyond that and do that. But just to give you another example of what you were talking about, you know, that.
Can I ask you a question?
Hold on just a second, Ms. Swant. We've already went over 12 minutes of the program here, and this has been really fascinating. So I'm going to let Jim answer one more question if you just want to kind of finish up with that thought you have right now.
Okay, well.
Yeah, Jim, hold on. Let her finish.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I think that fighting for local, substantive, you know, but radical reforms, you know, on material questions is not mutually exclusive from raising the larger banner of world socialism. And so, it's a concrete example is, you know, we are fighting on all the burning issues that are galvanizing working people in Seattle, like affordable housing, minimum wage, progressive taxation. But that doesn't stop us from also, for example, issuing a statement in solidarity with the people in Gaza because it allows us to show people that our fight against the big developers, against big corporations in Seattle is not in any way removed from a larger fight of the working class. And we have to build solidarity across national boundaries. I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a very interesting show, and I'm happy to... We're all glad to listen to your views on this. I just wanted to bring up the question of sewer socialism that David mentioned. The reason that term came about is that the socialist government in the city of Milwaukee created the first organic fertilizer from the Milwaukee sewers, Milorganite. And they also created the first kindergarten in America.
Wow. Okay. Well, Ms. Sawant, this has been a very fascinating interview. I hope you didn't mind that it went a little longer than usual, but wow, I mean, there's just so much here. We could go on for longer too, but I know you're a very busy person, so thank you very much for calling in, and we wish you the best of continued luck.
Thank you very much, and I did not mind that at all. As you said, we could talk all day and all night about
yes.
this. It's important.
But I love your idea of having a nationwide conference,
yeah,
you know, of all different, you know, sectors out the people, whatever, however people identify themselves, because I think unity is the most important thing, because that's how the ruling class seems to get away with what they do, is they keep us continuously divided. So I wish you the best of luck in that and look forward to that happening sometime soon.
Thank you. Thank you. Wish you all the best as well.
Okay. Take care. Okay, this is, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT. You just heard a 45-minute interview with Socialist Seattle Council member Shama Sawant. We went over a little bit on that because it really got into some good nuts and bolts conversation there about the how-tos as well as the whys, of course. But you're not going to hear this kind of interview or conversation on any commercial corporate radio station. I guarantee you that. And so please, in that regard.
And by the way, if you happen to tune in late and miss it, you can probably find it within a few days at radioforall.net. And that is the numeral four.
Yes. That's in our archive. So, please, you know, we're in pledge drive mode and, anything that, you can do to help us stay on the air would be appreciated. You can call in at 359-9338, at any time and, make a donation. Any amount's appreciated. Like I said, we don't particularly like doing this twice a year, but you know it's necessary for us to stay on the air. So please, if you enjoyed this interview and would like to hear more such interviews and topics that you're not going to hear on corporate radio station, please consider us and help us stay on the air. Call in at 217-359-9338. So please, until next week, be safe and power to the people. And next, stay tuned for the Union Edge. Take care.